Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Exchange. This is Cheryl Castile. My guest on the show today, I'm really glad to have her here in the studio, is Kathy Richard. And it's interesting, there are people that we all come in contact in the arts and cultural world here throughout Acadiana, and a lot of times people don't know someone's full history or their past history. They only know them as the current hat that they are wearing. But my guest, Kathy Richard, is the healthcare initiative director for the Louisiana Cultural Economy Foundation. Prior to that, for years, and still is, however, not out there as much as she was, Kathy's a really talented artist and native craftsperson, and also the owner and operator of the nonprofit Richard Sale Barn in Abbeville. So welcome, Kathy.
What an introduction. Hope yeah. I can live up to it.
Well, you better say some good things today.
Yeah. I'll try.
So it's good to have you here today.
It's good to see you. We've been friends for a really long
time.
That's
right. Yeah. And you know, and I guess that's part of, I know a lot of about your history with, you know, who you have been out there and who you still are, just because we have so much contact, both personally and professionally. But, you know, Kathy, I do think that there is a lot of people out there that don't know about your history as an artist.
I started, well, I went to UL, well, USL, let's just go ahead and say it the way it is.
That's
USL,
right.
In those days, and I was an applied art major, majoring in photography and journalism, but was taking some design jewelry courses, and ultimately that's what I hit on to actually make money, you know, started designing earrings.
Initially... Were you working, because the part that we're going to get into in a little bit too is your use of native items from the area. When you first started making jewelry, what items were you using at that point?
Well, I started with alligator teeth because...
Oh, you did?
I did, because as a photographer, I went to photograph a hunt. And that's what brought me. And, of course, you know, I grew up with brothers, no sisters. So at the end of the hunt, they never actually had a woman on a hunt before. And so they were a little skeptical. But by the time we got back, you know, I was sort of a mascot. And they handed me this giant alligator head. Yeah, as like a trophy, you know. And I think they all expected me to go, ooh, you know. And I went, oh, how cool. Yeah, great. You know, so... took the teeth out, you know, buried it, like they said, buried it in your backyard, let the teeth come out.
Now, what was the purpose for burying it?
Well, first of all, it's got an odor that, you know, you really don't want to have hanging around.
Okay.
And you need to bury it or put it in an ant pile for everything to come off of the skull to be able to get the teeth out.
Oh, yeah, so it's the process for cleaning it
exactly.
up and all that. Okay, yeah.
So made some jewelry for friends, and my friends started selling them off their ears and off their necks, and realized that, you know, well, maybe I could make a little bit of money out of that. So started going into it full time, and it just evolved.
Because there's also, and I'm assuming the regulations are still in place,
mm-hmm.
but when you're working with alligator, there are a number of regulations that
Absolutely.
You do have to follow through, correct?
Yes.
You know, when you're making jewelry also.
Yes. You have to have a license to purchase alligator parts, and you use that license. And, of course, you have to get a tag number from each alligator that you get the parts from. So you have to keep it on record. And as you sell the jewelry, you're supposed to write that tag number down. But, of course, you know, when I had... you know, a bunch of teeth, you know, you can't sort, oh, this one came from here or here. So,
yeah.
You know, I was just randomly using a tag number. But,
yeah.
Yes, you do have to keep accurate records.
Of how many you use,
how many,
the whole bit.
Yes, the whole thing, yep. What hunter you got it from. But which is great because Louisiana really brought the alligator back from endangered species and the regulations were part of it.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, so a lot of people, too, would think of the alligator using... for the meat,
mm-hmm.
and then the hide. I think
mm-hmm.
a lot of folks know that. But, you know, there's that whole part of, you know, kind of recycling, repurposing.
Absolutely.
I mean, really using the whole bit. From the jewelry, did you go from the jewelry then into, because I remember another thing you used to make is you did the knives that were from the jawbones.
Yeah. Well, that came about because, you know, you take all the teeth out and you have all these bones. left over. And what are you going to do with them, you know? So I started filling up holes in my yard with these bones. And running over it with my car, it slipped my tire. It slipped my tire. So I started talking to some older hunters about it. And they said, yeah, that, you know, the Indians used to make knives out of them.
I had no, see, I never heard that story. That's true. How you started doing that.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So, you know, they really, so you take the jawbone, the bottom jaw, and you can do the top, but mostly the bottom. And you can cut away a portion, and it really is so very hard and dense. And you can hone it to a fine point. But, of course, I was selling them as letter openers, so, you know. Kind of keeping it a little safe around there.
That's right. Yeah. And you did school programs back then.
I did, going into the schools. And I think one of the things, more than just the jewelry, I would start off my talk, because when I was younger, everybody knew who they wanted to be in school. I want to be a teacher. I want to be a doctor. And I had no clue who I wanted to be. And that's because I was an artist. And I was not exposed to the arts to be able to say, oh, this is what I'm attracted to. This is what I want to be. So when I go into
schools. And
it's
not always a thing back then that's brought up as here's your options.
Yes.
You know, when you're young, here's
so,
what you can.
And I actually was attracted to the theater. And when I got to high school, they cut the theater out, you know, taken away from school time. But I realize now, looking back, it's because I was attracted to culture and art. And so I tell kids, you know, if you don't know what you want to be, try art. You know, don't let that still be an option for you as a career, you know?
Yeah.
Because there are lots of ways you can make money in culture and art. You know, you don't have to be a starving artist, you know. You can hone your skills and go through college and find a way.
Do you remember back then, Kath, when that was your main focus, you know, when you were working as an artist and doing the school programs and a native craftsperson, do you remember just some stories back of, like, people you met? You know, some of the people who were some of maybe those tradition bearers, you know, back then?
I can't recall any, but I was fortunate enough to go to Europe, to France several times with Philippe Gustin. We were doing international trade shows. We would go to France and do a whole Louisiana world. We were going...
Oh, yeah.
You know, chefs, artists, musicians. You know, we would go about 60 people and work about 2 weeks at a trade show, you know, promoting Louisiana.
Oh, fascinating.
And just the experience of being there and as an artist and meeting other artists that were there. I was able to go to Nova Scotia and for the first Congrès Mondial as a visiting artist. And just being able to meet other artists was fascinating for me. And, of course, you know, got to bring in my significant other, Johnny, you know, who's another tradition bearer artist as a saddle maker. And we would go to France together sometimes not.
So he would go too.
Mm-hmm. I made five trips. He made two.
Okay.
Maybe three.
And that was an art that was in his family.
Absolutely.
From growing up.
Third generation cowboy. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how old was he when he started making saddles?
I think he always repaired his own, as most cowboys do. You know, they have to repair their own. But I think he was, we were just married, so I would say he was 38, 40, before he really went into it as a business.
And his dad did that?
His dad had the stockyard, the sale barn.
Which is now the Richard Sale Barn.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so he never did any saddle or leather work. Johnny took that on for himself. But again, as all cowboys, they learn to do their own repair work.
Yeah,
and then
again,
he just evolved and made handmade whips, which is definitely a lost tradition.
Yeah. So the experience that you had going to do those trade shows and going to Europe, did that have an effect on the direction that your life took, or how you viewed, you know, what you were doing as an artist?
I always, when I first started with the jewelry, someone said to me one time, you know, well, this fad's going to go out, you know.
This fad?
Yes, because of making alligator teeth jewelry and things.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I always saw it as an artist just evolving. You know, yes, I'm going to make it look like this year and maybe next year. And then, you know, if I don't grow as an artist, you know, alligator teeth was my medium.
Yeah.
And so I just said, I'm going to take it as far as I can see. You know, I can't see how far I can take it, so I'm just going to keep going. And I think using different, you know, silver, turquoise, you know, the garnet, you know, wire wrapping, evolving into that, scrimshawed, did some designs on the teeth themselves. And
what do you use for that?
I just used a scratch-all.
What is that?
It's a very, very pointed knife. It's not a knife. It's like a...
Kind of like an X-Acto knife?
Yes, but it doesn't have a blade. It just has a point.
Oh, it has the point on it.
Yes.
Okay.
And would just, you know, would carve into the tooth. You know, and it's very hard, very dense. It's very difficult to do. I didn't do a lot of them, but I did some good pieces back then.
Yeah. You know, it was interesting when I guess I first found out about that whole form of art and native work was from you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you think about us as human beings, the different sized teeth, but the alligator teeth really come in the different sizes.
Yeah, because what you see sticking out of the skull is very small portion of what the tooth is like.
Yeah.
I mean, you might see an inch sticking out of the skull, and they got three more inside.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So, and I looked it up, and the name of my company back then was Swamp Ivory.
That's right.
Because teeth are dentine and dentine. You know, it wasn't exactly ivory, you know,
as
a elk tooth is considered ivory. But, you know, it was a play on words and a little, you know, our own, like the Cajun Riviera was, Holly Beach. You know, it was our own ivory, here in the swamp ivory.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Now, are you still making jewelry?
I started looking back, now that I'm working more in an office and I have a little bit more time. What really happened was that I developed extreme carpal tunnel in both of my hands. It was becoming extremely painful to do it, you know. And so I kind of got backed off of it. But now that my hands are getting better, I started doing some more. Again, I'm going back to doing it for family and friends.
Yeah.
You know, Christmas gifts.
That's
I guess
right.
I've made it full circle now.
Yeah, so are you.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Well, I do know that is a piece because there have been a number of different people when we're having a conversation about you in connection with the healthcare initiative, and I will bring up about your artwork. It's interesting how many people. What? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know,
I'm getting back into photography as well, which was my first love.
Yeah.
I realized that I'm going to a lot of musical events and have this wonderful opportunity to photograph these musicians and just my environment. So I've gotten back into photography, which Elmore Morgan was always. He was one of my art teachers. Every time I'd see him, he'd always ask me, "Are you back in photography yet?"
Yeah,
no, not yet. But he's gone. But I'm telling him I'm back. You know.
So how did you first pick up a camera? How did that come into your life?
That's really an odd story.
Can we tell it on air?
We can. My first husband was a musician,
okay.
Mark Hebert from Gaydon. I'm from Gaydon. He bought me my first camera, and I bought him his first fiddle.
Ah, interesting.
And I just was interested in taking photographs, and so he bought me a camera 1 year for Christmas, and he was interested in playing a fiddle, so we just kind of, did an exchange thing. And
yeah.
He ended up being a very well-known fiddle player.
That's right.
And I went on to major in photography and take pictures.
Oh, so that's what do you like to focus on?
General things interest me, but I think if I had to pick one thing, if they said you can only photograph one thing for the rest of your life, I love night photography.
Hmm.
I love neons. I love movement with light. I love the nighttime and the neon as juxtaposed to the dark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very nice. Well, we're going to take a short break here. You brought in some music because we are going to talk about that historic place, the Richard Sale Barn. And Mike Dean is an individual who has played out at your place.
Twice, actually.
Twice it has been.
Yep.
All right. Well, we're going to listen to a cut, and it's from his CD, Middle Ground, and the cut that we are going to listen to is that Invincible?
Cincinnati.
Okay. Well,
unless we change the
folks, I should put my glasses on.
Unless we change the cut.
This is a cut by Mike Dean.
It's a journey I put off way too long. Gotta find myself and where I belong. I'm writing down the words to a brand new song tonight. I looked in the mirror and said goodbye. Hey, I'm leaving that life behind. And now these tires, they're like the tide. They just keep on rolling. Headlights and taillights and billboard signs. Destination not in mind. All I know is I know when I get there. Yeah, I'm leaving on a westbound highway prayer. Colorado coffee, John. I'm driving slow. I can taste the snowflakes coming through my window. I gave up cigarettes 33 minutes ago. I looked in the mirror and said goodbye. Hey, I'm leaving that life behind. And now these tires, they're like the tide. You just keep on rolling. This headlight. I'm leaving that life behind. And now these tires, they're like the tide. Just keep on rolling. There's headlights and taillights and billboard signs. Destination not in mind. All I know is I know when I get there.
All right, that was Mike Dean, and that was, now that I have my glasses on, that was Cincinnati. Sorry about that, Mike. That's a beautiful song.
He's great.
Yeah.
He's really good.
He's someone that that you've had you said you've had out at the barn a couple times. Mm-hmm. What is it that you like about Mike Dean and what he does musically?
I love, first of all, his voice is so soothing to me. I just really like it a lot. And I think he's one of the unknown Americana artists that we have here. You know, we have Cajun, we have Zydeco, we have blues, we have rock, you know. But Americana, he sings about what's going on in rural life, you know, and here. And we talked about, I have two favorite offshore songs, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Mike Dean's 7 and 7 is just so awesome. In the very beginning, he...
Like working seven on.
Yes.
Yeah, being off seven. Yeah, yeah.
And he talks about being the first... When he starts off his song, he starts about being in the helicopter and he's, you know, flying. And the way he enunciates his song and the melody he has, I actually feel like I'm flying.
Yeah.
You know? And it just... Through his music, you get this imagery. Very, very strong imagery.
Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, this is The Exchange. And my guest in the studio today, Kathy Richard, is the Healthcare Initiative Director for the Louisiana Cultural Economy Foundation, where actually she spends time all across the state. But also, her and her husband, Johnny, have the Richard Sale Barn, the historic Richard Sale Barn, which is a nonprofit organization and a wonderful venue for listening to music. Michael Juan Nunez, who plays another one of your favorite offshore songs.
Yes, Water and Steel.
Yeah, and he's we're going to play that a little bit. And he's going to be coming on doing a show at the Richard Sale Barn coming up in, 2 weeks? On the 21st of December?
On the 21st, the 7th annual Michael Juan Nunez Christmas show on the Bayou.
Yeah. Do you know, I went to... I don't know if it was the first one or the second one. And one of my favorite things was when he does Born on the Bayou, when he does that song.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was just, it was a great setting. It was like all these folks who knew him for years, people that knew that Richard Sale Barn. It was a really cool experience to be there at that.
It is. And now his favorite song for his Christmas show is, if you have not heard him sing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you are missing it, because I did not know Rudolph could sound so sexy.
Yeah.
I mean, he just makes it, you know, the women in the audience, we're all fanning ourselves when he finishes that song. You know, it's just wonderful. Yeah.
That's good.
We all wait for it every Christmas, you know.
All right,
it's like watching It's a Wonderful Life. You got to come see Michael Juan at the barn.
Yeah,
you know?
Only you're panting and
yes,
you're heavy.
Exactly. Yes.
You know, we were talking before, you know, we took a short break and went to the song with Michael Dean. When you were working as an artist, Kathy, you started experiencing some issues with carpal tunnel. And I'm curious, you know, now that you work with the Healthcare Initiative, which really focuses on healthcare for artists throughout the state and cultural workers, did that, experiencing that carpal tunnel, did that, was that a step kind of that took you into the direction you're focusing on now?
It did, because I was experiencing severe pain in both of my hands, more in the left than the right. I was doing a lot of wire wrapping and just really didn't know where my career was going to go, because at that point I was really, you know, having to do some, you know, major thought changing. At the same time.
Which is scary when,
because I've been doing it for 18 years.
Yeah.
So if you're not an artist, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah, yeah.
So my friends, the Boltmans, had started the New Orleans Musicians Clinic, and we were good friends with them. And she called me one day and said that they were opening a healthcare for musicians here in Lafayette. Jeannie Salas, you know, was doing that. And they were going to get some funding from New Orleans, but they wanted someone on the ground floor here in Lafayette to be their liaison. And so I said, well, yeah, you know, I don't mind doing that, but I really don't have a lot of, you know, that kind of experience, you know. And my friend Bethany said, yeah, but we'll teach you that. You know, it's like everything I would say, you know, don't worry about that, you know.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of fell into that and had a lot of wonderful people helping me along the way to, you know, learn how to write a grant, learn how to write a proposal, you know, just all of those things. And I had a supervisor many years ago that said, you know, you're destined for for other things, you know, and I had no idea. I had just started, you know, 3 months.
Yeah.
And, but I really realized that this is the job God always meant me to have.
Hmm.
I was married to a musician. I was a visual artist. I didn't have health care for the up until about 2 years ago for my whole adult life. Living from, you know, not even a paycheck, but just living from, you know, show to show. So I really know what they need. I've been there. I've had to weave the system. I've had to look and see how can I make it work for me, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And so I have empathy and, you know, some experience in that. So,
well, and it's also, too, you know, if you are in the type of employment where, you know, you don't go into the office Monday through Friday, although many artists, they have a set routine where they mm-hmm. go and make, but you don't always know what you're going to sell. You know, it's not like you're guaranteed a set pay each time. And when you start experiencing some health issues, you know, so many people, their initial reaction is to try to ignore it.
Yeah.
Because of that fear of, oh my gosh, how much is it going to cost me? What if it is really something much more than I think it is? And how am I going to pay for that? I don't have the kind of insurance, you know. Whether for some people it's either just catastrophic or it's nothing.
Yeah.
You know?
It was hugely scary for me. I actually got very ill with a thyroid condition and had to go to New Orleans, and they helped me. So, again, another experience that I had that other people would have. What do I do? Where do I go? And, you know, got into the UMC at the time, UHC right now, and was able to figure out how am I going to show my income, because I don't have a paycheck stub,
yeah.
which is what they all ask for,
yeah.
you know. And we were filing income taxes, but in between the time you file your taxes, your income changes
yeah.
from month to month,
That's
as
right.
you said, from show to show. So I was able back then to really get them, well, why don't you take my bank statements? It will show my income from month to month, you know, and it will be current. And they did that. They agreed to do that. And so all of the places we send our culture workers to, I make that agreement with them, all the clinics and doctors. You know, if you're going to take them on a sliding scale, you need to take their bank statements, you
yeah.
know, because that will show their income and current and, you know, but they don't have a paycheck stub.
Yeah. Kathy, you know, if somebody's listening today, you know, a artist, cultural worker, how would they get in touch with you? What's the best way that they can do that?
They can just go, probably for the radio, just go to culturaleconomy.org, and then they can click on healthcare and they can find my contact information. Because yeah. while our foundation is main office is in New Orleans, my office is here in Lafayette.
Yeah.
I'm housed with Acadiana Community Media at the Rosa Parks Center. So
it's a beautiful new setting.
Oh, it's a great
they
place.
Have over there.
Yeah.
yeah.
So I'm here in Lafayette, but to get me, you know, probably through the radio without giving a phone number, and I'll have to write it down, just go to cultureleconomy.org.
And then it's also good, too, for the website to find out what else is all offered through
exactly.
the Louisiana Cultural Economy Foundation. It's a wonderful organization that really helps out the artists and cultural workers, you know, here in the area. The job that you have now travels you throughout the state.
We are a statewide foundation, yeah.
One of the other organizations that you have been working with and one of your focuses is the tobacco-free living.
It's very important that our musicians have smoke-free workplaces. Everyone else does. And I'm going to say this wonderful statistic because I think it's so telling about Louisiana. 73% of Louisianians believe that you should have a smoke-free workplace. 73% of Louisianians do not believe bars are workplaces.
Oh,
so there's that disconnect between, yes, you should not smoke in the workplace, which is generally to them an office, but bars are workplaces. People work in there. Our musicians work in there. And so it's
the
important.
The bartenders, the wait staff.
Everything. So it's important to us that musicians have smoke-free workplaces. And we have partnered with Tobacco Free Living, and we have 9 regions, and we're having 10 smoke-free events across the state, and it's called the Breathe Easy Tour.
Yeah.
And we had one in Hammond last month, and we've had one in Opelousas on December 6th.
Yeah, just the last Friday.
Yes, last Friday.
Yeah.
So It's important that we start letting people realize that we want them to just smoke outside. It's about indoor air.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, so there have been, you know, I think David Egan is a perfect example. You know,
yes.
People that have experienced severe health issues due to that secondhand smoke.
Yeah. Never smoked a day in his life. He had stage 2 lung cancer by the time it was detected. Which I'll say also, we have our foundation, through Benefit the Boogie with Dave and Rhonda Egan, offer free lung cancer screenings for musicians. They can get
nice.
In touch with me. We have an imaging center that they can go get chest x-rays and free of charge. And, you know, just because of their hazards of work conditions and David's and Rhonda's experience with it, that's how he survived a chest x-ray.
Yeah. Yep. You know, and I do, Kathy, this is, you know, what I talked about at the very beginning when I was introducing you, is I do think you come at this job with a very unique perspective because of, you know, like you said, you were married to a musician, married to, you know, a native craftsperson. Now, for quite a few years, you yourself have been a working artist, and you also have a venue.
Yeah,
I mean that gives you a really well-rounded idea of what this all entails, and you know what artists go through, and you know, separate from the healthcare, I always look at it too. You know, you having a venue, you having worked as an artist, you know, there's that whole business aspect too.
Oh, yeah.
Of you know, what artists have to go through when you get that.
Yeah.
You know, when
yeah.
artists have to book a gig, when they have to negotiate for funds. I mean, that's a tough thing to do. You
it
know?
Is. It is. And I think there's that I was speaking to some musicians a while back. There's that whole thing that's lacking, I think, in Lafayette, that, you know, it's always a struggle to get that business perspective. Tipitina's has been having some wonderful workshops, and I think that's also an underused resource here in Lafayette is our Tipitina's Music Co-op.
Yeah.
And
that's located on Jefferson Street now,
it is,
correct?
Right around the corner from me, the end, right before you get to the underpass, the end of Jefferson. And they have great resources for music professionals, you know, is really the best way to say that, because it's agents, it's producers, it's the musicians themselves, and getting the tools that they need to be successful and to move forward beyond just playing Saturday night, which if that's what they want to do, that's perfectly fine. But if they want to, and now, you know, our musicians here have had great success with the film industry.
Yeah, that's right.
Michael Wan is one. CeCe Adcock, Terrence Simeon. But we've had several. Deej Legg has had their songs put on TV shows.
Louis Michaud,
HBO.
Louis.
Yeah. So, you know, how do other musicians get that?
Yeah.
How do they get to that level? What do they need to do? Is something.
And then
that,
I think when you get it, how do you understand what to do with it?
Exactly.
You know, how to work through the process.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, so many, you know, you talk about artists and for a number of artists, there is that certain way of thinking, certain way of working that doesn't always fit the need or the skills that you do need for the marketing end of that, the business end of that. You know?
Because that can be brutal.
That's right. And I think of, you know, certain visual artists, musicians who I know are good at that. Trish Ransom, I think of right away with Debris. She's, you know, and she worked for years as a marketer and in retail. She gets it. Eric Adcock's another one, you know, a talented musician, but he really gets the business end. But that's not how everybody works.
No. I know as an artist, it's hard to hear something bad about your intellectual property.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Be it music or art. But sometimes you have to leave that at the door.
Yeah.
You know, and also negotiate for what you think is correct.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a matter of, you know, what you feel your worth is and sometimes sticking to it.
That's right. Well, we're going to listen to your other favorite offshore song.
Great.
By Michael Juan Nunez, and that's Water and Steel. Has he performed that song at the barn?
Oh, yes, many times.
Yeah, very cool.
And when I said offshore song, I think it's because it's part of that culture that not many people talk about, sing about, you know. But it is such an ingrained That's part of our culture.
Christy Guillory did, I can't think of the name of the song now. It's a Jody. And that talked.
That's Michael and Mike Dean's song, 7 and 7, talks about Jody.
Yeah.
Got my girl and gone.
That's right. That's right. Well, this is Michael Juan Nunez, and this is off of his CD, About to Snap. And this is Water and Steel.
Water and Steel. Water and Steel. Crack. Water and steel. Water and steel. Well, the fall moved in, thick offshore. I should have been to the Paris line. Water and steel. 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 Water and steel.
Michael Juan Nunez, Water and Steel. If you're just joining us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at krvs.org. We want to give a thank you to all of our supporters out there because this is listener-supported public radio. And if you'd like to check out how, if you're not a member and you would like to become a supporting member of KRVS, you can go to the website. It's a safe and secure site. Also a great place to check out all the podcasts of all of our locally produced shows, which we've got a number of them, over 30. It's a great, great local station here, plus featuring national and international news. My guest in the studio today, Kathy Richard, is a multi-talented individual from being an artist to an administrator with a service that's so important for so many of our artists and cultural workers out here with the, as the healthcare initiative director for the Louisiana Cultural Economy Foundation. The Richard Sale Barn, which is a wonderful historic venue. How did that come about, Kathy? The place itself is in your husband Johnny's
family. Well, when Johnny and I got together, we had the barn on the property where we live, and we decided that we wanted to keep it. It was just so wonderful, and it was part of his growing up, his history, you know, his whole being. And the rest of the family was not real sure they wanted to keep it. So we then started exchanging property so that we could get, you know, be able to keep it. Then once we had it, you know, what to do with it. About that time, Johnny was beginning to make saddles. So his saddle shop was in the barn, which was a great place to be. And as people would come into his shop, we'd open the door sometimes to show where the theater is, the where people would buy the animals. And they would always say, which is so cool, when I was a little kid, I would sit, and they would always have a special place that they would point to, you know, because like going to church on Sunday, you always sat in the same place,
you know,
when you came with your family. But again, we still didn't know what we really wanted to do with it until we had a friend come in with a guitar one day and just started playing music. And he said, you know, this is some of the best acoustics I've ever heard, ever. You know, you should turn this into a theater, a, you know, concert hall. And Johnny and I just looked at each other and went, okay, yeah, that's great. That's what we'll do. You know, so we just started moving forward with it because it just, it resonated perfect to us. Yes, that's exactly what we should do with it. You know.
Now, it's on the historic register.
It is.
Isn't it? That's a lot of work.
It was the first barn in Louisiana to be put on the historical registry, and it was a lot of work.
Wow.
A labor of love, but we showed that there were cultural significance to this building. People did two things to visit with each other. They went to the sale barn on Tuesday and to church on Sunday. So it was a cultural gathering of people to come and not only get what they needed food-wise, you know, buy their animals and... but they would meet each other and they would exchange stories and gossip and what's going on with you.
Yeah, you know.
So it had huge cultural significance.
Yeah.
Yep.
And there was some actual like work on the interior, exterior that you that did you have to do?
No, actually, you can't do.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So you and actually, when we put it on in 1997, when it went on. I believe that's a year, close enough. But it had to be 50 years as it stands now.
This
was the third building. Mr. Avery, J. Avery Richard, built the business. His son, John, and Roland and Lloyd, his three sons, came back from the war, and they did some renovations and enlarged it. So the building in 1942 is the way it looks now. So we had to wait 50 years, 1992, so then it took another five before it was put on the registry.
Yeah. What year was it when you started doing music out of there?
7 years ago. So
oh, 7 years ago. Oh, yeah, 7 years ago. Okay.
Because once we put it on the registry.
2006
and we,
or so?
Yeah, formed the nonprofit. We hadn't done a whole lot with it. We didn't have any money to do it to visual artists. And then we started getting some money from a hotel motel taxes. And the way we really moved into it was kind of odd. We Johnny and I have been written in because we're such a...
Now, this is in Abbeville, we should say.
Yes.
We didn't mention where the Richard
Sale were. Abbeville, Louisiana.
Yeah, it's in Abbeville. And so that's in that's Vermilion Parish.
It is.
Yeah.
We were written up on several tour books. You know, a guy who makes saddles and a woman who does jewelry with alligator teeth is kind of an oddity, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
So we had a group call us from France and said that they were a choir, 37-piece choir called Opus 37, and they had read about us, and they wanted to come to – they were doing a tour of South Louisiana, working their way, you know, and they wanted to come and perform at the barn. And so I said, well, you know, okay, yeah, oh, that's good, you know.
Yeah.
Sticking my feet in before, you know, anything.
At that time, did you have the stage
built?
We
did not.
Oh, wow, okay.
So it was
one of
those,
weren't ready.
Yeah, you know, they're coming, we need to build it.
Yeah, and but so, sometimes that's what it needs. You know, you taste
it
that.
It's actually what it took.
Yeah, it really did.
So wonderful friend Johnny Hebert, who was a carpenter extraordinaire, and Johnny, my husband, and a couple other friends built the stage on top. And, I mean, not a moment too soon before Opus got there. And they were, again, a 37-piece choir.
Wow.
They sang in St. John's Cathedral. So we were a little nervous that they were coming to the barn.
Yeah.
What would they expect? What would people expect? Yeah. You know. So we brought the director into the barn, and you know, of course, we're like little children, you know, waiting to hear did it meet his approval? And he just kind of sang something because they were a cappella. I forgot to mention that. Total, no music, just a cappella.
Yeah.
And he started singing. He said, "This is fabulous," you know. And so we were like, "Oh, great!"
Thank goodness.
Yeah. So that was in October, and we had Juan for our first Christmas show, and there it goes.
You know, so how the stage is built, you know, just to describe to people, you built the stage up, but it was above where they would bring the animals out when it was the sale barn,
right?
Correct.
There's a big iron fence, as you can imagine, to hold the animals in the little pit at the beginning. And the stage, the seating, is like an amphitheater.
Yeah.
It's like wooden bleachers. And we built the stage right on top. So you sort of look up unless you go up the bleachers. But it's still so wonderful because it's made out of wood. And so it's hollow underneath. So the music reverberates through the wooden stage into the crowd underneath.
Yeah.
And it was built, the reason it's so acoustically sound, it was built before microphones. So the auctioneer's voice in the 40s had to be able to carry throughout the crowd. So it was really built, you know, with acoustics and, you know, an amphitheater sound in mind. Because, again, you got the animals that are really loud.
Sure.
So you really have to be able to hear.
Yeah, and the auctioneer, you can't just hear, but you have to be able to understand what they're saying.
Right.
You know, if you're there bidding.
And then a few years later, did get microphones and, you know, things did get better. But they had that in mind when they built the theater as it is now.
Well, and I bet since you have opened it now as a venue, I would imagine you're having people come through who are sharing stories with you.
Yes, yes.
Of back when.
Yes.
Do you remember some of the stories that kind of stand out? Or like, what do people talk about when they talk about the barn back then?
They mostly talk about when they were children and their view of the world. You know, they would come with their grandparents. And actually, I wish Johnny was here because he has a lot more stories. But his grandfather spoke French only.
Yeah.
And he viewed anyone who did not speak French as an American.
Yeah.
You know? And les Americans were only allowed to sit in certain areas. So if
you spoke French,
you could sit in the prime seats. But if you didn't, you had to sit in other areas. So when people come in and they say, "I used to sit there," my first question is, "You spoke French or your grandfather or father?" And
sure.
They said, "Yes," you know. But it was very cultural to him. He, you know, he viewed his culture as, you know, a pride. And he, anyone else was not. You know?
Yeah.
But they mostly talked about seeing all the things that were going on as children, you know, men speaking French, the auctioneer's voice, the hearing the animals, you know, the whole imagery, you know, and how it was just so fun to come here, you know, and witness that and to experience it, you know.
You know, it's interesting. I remember the first time I was there with the music, with a concert. But then you would also hear, I don't know if you had goats back in there.
Yeah, we had goats at one time.
And you would hear in between you would hear the goats back there, which so fit.
Yeah, it's an experience. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And it wasn't, you know, there was no disruption, none of that. It just fit for what the place was.
We have horses in the back still, you know, and one of our friends from France kind of gave us our little theme. We have yet to make T-shirts, but I swear I'm going to make them. That says, you know, it's one of the most unique live music venues. And his thing was that where you can smell the culture.
Where you can.
Which, of course, you know, there's no unpleasant odor. So
no,
don't not
that's
come to the barn, you know, because you think it's going to smell. But, you know, that was
But that's right. Because there's feedback. I mean, the hay, the straw,
exactly.
All of that stuff.
And the leather from Johnny's leather shop and, you know, the whole cowboy atmosphere, you know, which is, again, another dying culture of Louisiana. Vermilion Parish was the largest livestock producing parish, and Rita wiped that out, you know. So
that's right.
Whole families have stopped working cattle and doing that, you know. So, again, it's a very dying culture, you know, that resonates through many still in Vermilion Parish, but are seeing that slowly go by.
Yeah. You know, and I know Connie Castile has captured, you know, some of the history of some of that. But and I know you did a, you know, you did a presentation there, I don't know, quite a few years ago, too, with looking at the cowboy culture and some of the stories. Boy, that would be a nice project, though, to really
get
that history down, you know, with in terms of with folklorists and the whole bit.
Absolutely.
You know?
There are a few working cowboys in the Sagrera family that are still living that could give that historic culture voice.
Yeah.
But there's not that many left, really. And so that would be a wonderful project. I would love to help someone work on that or, you know, shoot them in the right direction. But it's leaving us, folks. We still have cowboys that ride horses, but not from the aspect of working cattle and it being their livelihood and that aspect.
That's right. Well, Michael Wan is going to be out at the Richard Sale Barn, as we mentioned, the annual Christmas show, and that's going to be on the 21st. And this is Michael Wan with the song Donkey Donkey.
Standing on the train tracks, you gotta watch for the train. And if you're cutting with the chainsaw, don't grab the chain. And all of us gamblers, we gotta deal with the cause. And if you stand behind the donkey, donkey, you're gonna get kicked hard. Don't stand behind the donkey, donkey, don't.
That's Michael Juan Nunez with Donkey Donkey. That's one of my favorite Michael Nunez songs. That's when I blast in the, really turn up in my vehicle or at home or whatever.
Roll the windows down
yeah,
and just
right.
kind of blare it out.
That's right. And Michael Juan will be at the Richard Sale Barn. If you are just joining us, my guest in the studio today has been Kathy Richard, who, amongst other things, is the Healthcare Initiative Director for the Louisiana Cultural Economy Foundation, but also has the Richard Sale Barn. And the 21st of this month, Michael Juan Nunez will be out there doing the annual Christmas show.
And you have to get your tickets early because it's always a sold-out show.
How do people do that?
They can go to our Facebook page and send me a message, Richard Sale Barn. Or they can go to my personal Kathy Richard Facebook page and send me a message, and I'll keep them. Because that's the easiest way. Again, on radio, try to blare out some phone numbers is pretty difficult. But,
Yeah, that's
And my email address is lebayou@bellsouth.net. They want to email me. But it's always a sold-out show. It's always a great show. And I've already had a lady call me. I need 35 tickets.
Oh, Lord, yeah.
And we only sell 100.
Yeah.
So it's an intimate experience that we don't oversell it so that, you know, people are just sandwiched in. We want them to have a good time.
That's right. So that's the 21st with Michael Juan. The next event that you would have coming up for through healthcare?
Through the healthcare initiative would be in January. We're going to have a free dental day for music professionals. I don't have an exact date.
Okay.
But they can, again, culturaleconomy.org and email me that they are interested in participating in the free dental day, sponsored by Music Cares. We also are going to have one in Baton Rouge, probably in February. So, you know, back-to-back months, we'll have some free dental days.
All right. Well, Kathy Richard, thank you so much for coming on today.
It was fun. Thank you, Cheryl.
Appreciate it. Yeah, and everybody, have a good week. If you can get to the barn, if you can get a ticket by the 21st, go out and see Michael Juan Nunez, and we're going to go out with Michael. This is Pocket Full of Jesus. Have a good week, everyone.
Gather round, you can save your soul, here's what's going down. I can free your mind and I make it easy. You can leave tonight with a pocket full of Jesus. I got $10 bags, I got $20 bags. I'll take rolls of pennies if you ain't got cash. There'll be no more sorrow, it'll free your mind. It's a pocket full of Jesus and it feels so fine. Shepherd the herd.